You're tuned into the Awakening Zone Radio Network, your news and information source for empowered spiritual awakening.
Hello, this is Karen Elkins at the Science to Sage Radio, and today, this hour, we're going to spend with Freddie Silva. He is one of the world's leading researchers in ancient systems of knowledge and the interaction between temples and consciousness. He is also a best-selling author and filmmaker. He lectures internationally with keynote presentations on international science and consciousness conferences and the International Society for the Study of Subtle Energies, Energy Medicine. In addition, he has appeared on the History Channel, Discovery Channel, BBC, and video documentaries, and now this radio show. Hello, Freddie.
Hello, Karen.
That's not my favorite part of the show. You know, being dyslexic, reading that stuff is like torture to my brain, but there you go.
And you get to lower your voice several decibels at the end when you say my show.
It's your show. So it is the Freddie Hour today.
Oh, no.
No, it is. So
people
with that,
find something better to do.
No, actually, I'm really looking forward to this because you're reading your book, as I said to you, the poor thing has been marred and marked up, and it is anything but gorgeous anymore, but it is totally used, and it's been loved, and the knowledge in it is just profound. So,
oh, good.
So it is. I mean, that's what I really wanted to get you on the show because there was a few things that it sort of tweaked my brain as I'm working on my own stuff at the moment. So here, this is an amazing legacy bequeathed to us by the creator gods. Today we're going to explore the many facets of temple building after the great floods in the gateway to paradise. So you know what? You mentioned that within these temples that they left clues for us for future generations to get back and to know the knowledge that's embedded within them. And you basically say that they mirror our own inner universe. So can you give us some insights, Freddie, to, you know, all of these? I mean, we're going to go through the seven thingies. We're going to definitely do the seven thingies. And but, you know, give us an overview of I want to know how do you describe these creator gods? Who are these creator gods that built these temples?
Well, if you look at some of the surviving texts, most of which seem to come either from southern India or from Egypt, they're very clear that before a great catastrophe that occurred across the face of the earth, and this was a monumental flood, which has now been proven quite categorically to have taken place in 9307 BC, maybe Tuesday or Wednesday, I'm not sure, that they're very adamant that this whole cataclysm was started by seven pieces of a meteorite that struck the Earth at very convenient locations that really took out 9/10 of the entire population. And if you're reading all these texts, they are very clear that when this catastrophe took place, the Earth was ruled by creator gods, and these people were not just mentally very big people. They thought in very big sort of brushes and patterns. They also were physically very, very tall people. And the survivors, all of whom appear to have had someone contact a human person to construct an ark into which they would place two of everything. This story goes around the world, by the way. There's about 146 identical flood myths. So these people, not just Noah, were told to take every specimen on Earth across the on board these boats, and then they were also to take on board seven sages, and these group of seven people were supposedly the spirit keepers and the knowledge keepers, the survivors of this old race, and they were described as half human, half divine, but still very, very tall. In fact, on the Temple of Edfu, they are actually measured at 5 cubits in height, which is about 15 feet. And these people had elongated skulls. They've been found all the way through North America. They're found in Europe, in the giants' graves in Britain, even in the Far East. So they're not a figment of the imagination. And it was basically their charge to take the original concept of how the creator gods had worked out a way in which to synthesize how nature works. So they looked at the stars, they looked at nature, and they were distilling the very essence of what it means to know the harmonics of the universe, how things really work. And they postulated that since we're souls trapped in a physical body down here, that we are slightly less than perfect. And once in a while, we, you know, kind of get it wrong. Things go squiffy, to put it into a very spiritual term. And they figured the only way to get yourself back into a state of perfection is to build temples to turn you into a mirror image of the gods or God. And this is not a religious concept. It's actually a philosophical concept. So they built these temples to literally mirror the very laws that shape the universe. So we're talking about the laws of magnetism, the laws and harmonics of music, of sound, sacred geometry, which basically is consciousness made manifest in nature. And so when you look at these temples that you do when you go around the world, and you get a sense that you're almost looking at yourself in the mirror, and that's because you are, because you're looking at yourself as a perfected being, but that perfected being is also a mirror of what happens around you in nature and in the rest of the universe as a hologram. So this was a huge vision. They realized that in times to come, i.e. ours, we would really get it squiffy. Things would go really, really bad. And we would know where to turn to. And so they left these temples across the face of the earth as a legacy, so we would know where to go at times when we lost the plot. And I tend to refer them as self-help centers. So whenever you're feeling a little bit out of sorts, for example, after living in Maine for 3 months of the winter like I do, I can't wait to get back on the land and get somewhere and just make contact with these places. And it's like I've just plugged my fingers back into a battery. And it really is very recharging. You do feel like you've plugged yourself back into this sort of universal matrix, and you feel like you're part of something much bigger. And it does make you feel wholesome, or to put it into our modern language, holy.
Well, you know, you basically say that they are built to be living, breathing organisms. And so you also talk, I mean, I've seen where the structures of the temples of the Vedas and the Catholic cathedrals are built, and if you actually look at it, they're structured like a body.
Exactly.
And so, yeah, and you describe that in your book as well.
Yeah, they actually talk about, in fact, I was quite amazed that people in the old days, I'm talking about 3000 BC here, they actually addressed the temple as a living being, as an animate being. I mean, the Egyptian priests would even go into the temple before the crack of dawn, and before, you know, with Venus sort of on the horizon, the planet of love and devotion. And they would go from room to room, awakening the parts of the temple as though they were waking a person from sleep. I mean, it's a very romantic ideal. Until you wait until, you know, 5,000 years later, where we can go into these places with very expensive equipment and find out that these places are actually alive. I mean, there's magnetism flowing through these places, and they seem to be attracted to the temples and not the surrounding landscape. So they are working as a kind of magnet to draw natural forces to their sanctum. And no wonder you sort of get that sort of the tingly-wingly feel when you go into these places, because there is a vibe there. And even inside the Gothic cathedrals, when you look at Chartres, for example, it's like being inside a musical box. Mm. And if you start getting your ruler out and being very subtle about it, you can actually measure the height and the width for the breadth of the nave, and you find it's all aligned to musical notation. So you are literally dancing inside, you know, the dance of Shiva, if you like, where you are living the actual music of the universe. So no wonder you sort of feel enlightened, you feel a bit more awakened, because the whole place literally is alive, even though it's cast in stone. Everything about it is moving, it's breathing in tandem as a correspondence to the rest of the universe. And that, of course, is done deliberately to get you into a state of receptivity, so you become much more aware of the world around you. And eventually, once you sort of calm down and stop taking photographs, you start getting in touch with yourself and realizing that you actually start vibrating in unison with the building, and the two of you become one, inseparable things. And at that moment, that's where the magic happens. And then, as I tell people when they come on my tours, be careful what you ask for, because you might just manifest it.
Well, you know, that goes back to the notion, Freddie, you know, when you look at these creator gods, they were almost, they were like the shamans. So you talk about in your book the Egyptians, where it took them 20 years to go through actually learning or going through the seven pyramids to actually understand how to move energy, how to be, and understanding that everything is made of elements. And that means the wind, the earth, the everything. And when they built the temples, it's like you're saying in the book, they put the water next to it. They made sure that that everything was on ley lines. So why don't you go into depth? Because it's like everything is alive. They didn't think of themselves as only, but they were part of it.
Oh, it's an incredible spiritual science, and it's only for after you walk through these places for 15 years that it really hits you that there is something going on regardless of what they look like. And I mean, you can be in Thailand in a stupa, or you can be in Stonehenge, and you suddenly realize that you're actually walking through the same space. They just happen to look slightly different because of the traditions that surround them. So yes, they literally did sort of harness these things in order to get you to have a sensory state of perception which was beyond yourself. So it was very important that you actually knew how to work this energy, because you know people this isn't sort of known very well, but people have gone into the Great Pyramid and they have sort of stayed overnight without being prepared, and people have died in there. Oh, yes, people have actually gone into the sarcophagus thinking that they're going to have a shamanic experience, and yes, you do. I mean, I've had one in there for just 10 minutes under imperfect conditions, and I can tell you, I went into places that I'm still struggling to understand, and that's just a 10-minute unprepared moment of quiet, which is very rare in the pyramid. Just to myself, and it was like having a shamanic moment. It was just like some people describe when they go into a state where they drink ayahuasca and they have that out-of-body experience. Those things can be very dangerous if you don't know where the nature of your soul, how it interacts with the elements, and also how to make sure you navigate the other world and come back into the body safely. The Egyptians were masters of this, because they recognized the dangers of leaving the body. For them, it wasn't just a fun and games thing. I mean, they were very serious about traveling into other realms, going there deliberately and consciously, and coming back with specific answers to specific questions. So it was very guided for them. I don't think they were much into suing anybody in those days. I think you either lived or you died, depending on your experience, or you went mad. And that was to be avoided at all costs. They basically wanted to make sure that when you went into these spaces and you left your body and you connected with the matrix, it was for your own benefit, and you come back with information either to further your spiritual development, so you live your life purposefully and awake, which is the whole purpose of these journeys. You basically are in total self-control. No one can tell you how to do things. And also, you'd bring back information that was relevant to the tribe, so the tribe would also benefit. And this is why these civilizations lasted for thousands of years, because they were in touch with something that gave them guidance, and very specific guidance. Whereas, you know, we today can barely keep a country together for 10 years without things falling apart. So they're obviously onto something that was very organic, and it was very beneficial. So it was well thought through. Everything was a mirror of the universe. And it was the perfection of everything. And when you reach that perfection, magic really does happen.
You know, the thing that strikes me when reading your book and a lot of other things that comes my way is that there was a time when it was a global philosophy, a global, I would wonder, what do you call it, a religion, an ideology, where these temples were very similar all over with the same intent. And we always seem to think that it's just mine in one country or another, but in truth, it seems like it was these guys had frequent flyer miles.
In more ways than you might think, actually.
No, I actually kind of agree that they actually had what is in the Vedas, it's the Vimanas, right?
Exactly. Well, that these people, these creator gods and the builder gods, even in South America, they keep talking about them flying over the ocean as though they're escaping some sinking island or something. And they seem to be flying all over the place. They land at these hot spots, which they always call the navels of the earth, mm-hmm. or the descending place of a god. In fact, we're about to go to Peru in October to look at some of these places that they actually do call locally the place where the god descends. And you've got to understand, well, there's a reason why it's called that. It's because there's an energy there that's so potent that it's palpable. Something actually did land there. And I'm not talking about spaceships here. I'm talking about people who really did understand the manipulation of matter, and that mm-hmm. they could travel. Almost like yogic flying in Tibet, and the stories of the monks who were able to travel through the air. I don't think they're making it up at all. I think they have the vestiges of a very, very, very old culture, and it survives there. So, this culture is worldwide, and you start looking at the etymology of things. Mm-hmm. You start finding Egyptian words in Easter Island, for example. I mean, the Easter Islanders, who also have a tradition of very, very tall people, that was still found there in the 18th century by a Dutch ship captain. They have the same word for spiritual being as the Egyptians. So you think about Easter Island, it's an island 19 miles long, the furthest point from anywhere, any landmass in the world.
Mm-hmm.
And still, how did the Egyptian language get there? How is it that when you put the Easter Island temples on the map, and you put other significant major sacred sites on a globe, excuse me, very dry in here, then you put these things on a map and you realize they're all intimately tied together by an invisible geometry. I mean, you're talking about a global alignment of temples using sacred geometry. I mean, unless you have a satellite, that's pretty hard to figure out. So obviously there was a grand plan that went back way before the flood, because all of these temples, what they all share in common is that they all seem to have started around 10,500 BC, which does precede the official date for the flood. So, yes, we're talking about something that's so remote that it's still with us today.
Hmm. Yeah, because I look at that and it just seems like, one, it's everywhere and there is one foundation, and all these things don't seem like myths. Actually, they seem like truth after a while when you start looking. So
the myths are wonderful carriers of truth.
Aren't they? They really are.
That's what amazes me about Orthodox historians. And not to knock them. They have their own point of view, and they're welcome to it. But when you start reading things from your own point of view, you're missing the subtlety, and the point as well, because you have to understand it from their point of view. Even to try and read Homer's Odyssey from our point of view, or even Shakespeare, it's really hard. It's bloody difficult.
Mm.
You have to understand Shakespearean English and the meter and the rhyme and iambic pentameter to get that rhythm, to understand the language and the patois, the way the tongue moves and the mouth. When you go back for 4,000 years, well, they're thinking along very different lines than we are. You have to see things from their point of view, and when you do, then the myths start coming very true. And I can't remember who it was. It's Fritjof Capra, a physicist back in the 70s who wrote a wonderful book called The Tao of Physics.
Yeah.
Lovely little book. And he actually made a very good point of looking at the Vedas and modern nuclear physics and finding that they're actually talking about exactly the same processes using very different language.
Yeah.
And I couldn't help but laugh back in 2001, I believe, when a whistleblower in NASA puts on the website at NASA, and I can almost remember the quote verbatim. It said that we have found portals that open from the Earth to the Sun every 9 minutes, and these things are magnetic.
Whoa!
And I thought, that's very interesting, because I remember reading somewhere in the Vedas that they talked about the serpents that slide along the ground are mirrored and flow in the skies. Now, the serpents, of course, were the energy lines.
Oh, yeah,
that flow everywhere.
Yep.
So the Vedas, which are now dated to something like 15,000 BC, if you do the calculations, and I believe Graham Hancock did, you find that they're talking about exactly the same natural processes. But to someone who sees everything very logically and linearly, it sounds like these people were smoking something very special. But they're not. They were trying to transmit something in their own method. And you have to be open to that. And once you do, the world opens up very, very greatly in front of you.
But you know what, to me, Freddie, that makes it seem like these were not people of the earth, because there's no way that the caveman looking into the sky would have figured that out, because you wouldn't have seen it.
Exactly. And this is where the dichotomy begins with the tall people. In fact, there's a project that I'm just working on right now, which I'm not really going to give too much away, except it has to do with resurrection, and it's very interesting. It suddenly dawned on me, looking at all of these myths and looking at how Orthodox archaeology looks at the history of the world, that there's so many... there's thousands upon thousands of cases of very tall people, anywhere between 7 to 9 to 15 feet, buried all around the world by the hundreds. And it made me wonder, well, if we suddenly arrived at a point in our culture where suddenly we go from mud huts to enormous pyramids in the blink of an eye, as though these things were flat-packed like a Neolithic IKEA.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, literally, this culture just arrives complete.
Right.
There's no progression. It tells me that it must have come from somewhere else. There must have been another race living with us on Earth who had a contact with another level of intellect. And it's not too far-fetched a notion to think that when the flood happened, and obviously not many people survived, those people who were between 9 and 15 feet tall looked at each other and thought, well, either we interbreed, which is not a good idea, or we have to start mating with humans, which is going to be a little bit uncomfortable for the girls.
Thinking that. Ouch, because... They're not so big.
Unless you're a pervert, I don't know.
I don't know. It's kind of weird.
but we'll do this on the 11 o'clock hour.
that had crossed my mind before.
We have.
You know, well, yeah, you think about it, childbirth, one-fourth of women died, and I mean, maybe that's part of the link to that in the old
it's
days.
It's possible, but it does make a lot of sense because suddenly the Egyptians are talking about going from the builder gods who were half human, half divine. Well, you think, well, where did it go from totally divine to half human, half divine? Well, that would make sense if they were now interbreeding with humans, but of course, their bloodline died out. I mean, Akhenaten, Tutankhamun are part of that bloodline. And you can see it in their skeletons and their skulls.
Yeah.
So Easter Island, the same thing. Even in the 18th century, they still had two races living there. And one of them were enormously tall. So it's not too far-fetched to suggest that then we did start interbreeding and at some point they did die out. Because in 3100 BC exactly, the Egyptians talk about the first pharaoh of a purely human bloodline, and that was Menes. And that starts off an entirely new dynasty. And that would now account for the fact that suddenly you've gone from huge pyramids, and if you look at the progression of temple building, if not just building in general around the world, but specifically temple building, it's gotten worse as we get closer to our era. And case in point, all you have to do is go to see how the temple, like in Luxor, which is actually the temple that you see there is about 2600 BC, which is, sits on the foundation of an older temple. But beside it is a Roman temple and bits which are added also by the Greeks. And you can tell just by the size of the stones, the stones are getting smaller and the construction is getting weaker. And the Roman temples did not stand up to scrutiny when earthquakes came along, whereas the Egyptian temples just got rattled a little bit. So obviously we've fallen from a very high civilization into what we see now. We've actually degraded, if you like. So all of these things do start making sense when you see it from that point of view.
Yeah, we've certainly gotten smaller in stature and are a lot more dense. I do get that.
Yes, unless in my case I'm the tallest Portuguese person you'll ever see.
Oh, that's true. I've had the pleasure of meeting Freddie. So Freddie is very tall. That was funny. The day I picked you up at the airport, you said, "What's the secret?" And I said, "Freddie?" Anyway, you said, "I guess that'll do." You know what you talked about, too, is Plato. Plato says, you know, people become detached and lose direction and purpose when we're not looking to the cosmos and to understanding how the whole cosmos is basically a living organism. We're part of it. We're like it. We're like all of the other biological systems. And so I think what I get is these creator gods understood something so profound, left us the clues, like you said. But here's one of the questions that I have relating to that. Tell me about the Adam and Eve story, because it's different in different cultures. But there's always some yummy fruit, and it's not always an apple. Right?
I was fascinated by the Gnostic Gospels and why the church spent 30 years and millions of dollars making sure that the Gnostic Gospels that were found in 1945 in a cave in Nag Hammadi in Egypt suddenly came to the forefront, and they seem to contradict the canonical Gospels. Suddenly there's the Gnostic Gospel of Mark, which actually talks about the real story that was told by Jesus. There was a very esoteric story that was told by him, as opposed to the official version of events. There was the Gospel of Philip that described Christianity as the faith of fools, and that anyone, and I quote this, anyone who believes in the resurrection is confusing a spiritual truth with an actual event. So for them, the resurrection was not meant to be taken literally. It was supposed to be actually a philosophical, allegorical concept. And I'm starting to sort of digress now. it's interesting that the stories that we sort of hear officially by the Catholic Church do have a very slanted political bias, because the church is founded on a piece of paper which was supposedly written to show that Peter was the authority was given to Peter, the apostle, from Jesus. And yet it's been proved again and again that the piece of paper is a complete manufacture. It's manufactured. It's a fraud. So the whole basis of the Catholic Church, I'm not having a dig at the faith. I mean, people should believe what they believe in, and that's fine. It's the method by which it's been transmitted. It's an actual fraud. And the Gnostics and the early Christians and the early Christian Gnostics, they knew this, and this was all written down. So it was an incredible sort of find to sort of go through the original Gnostic Gospels and read the original story of Adam and Eve. Because that's kind of where the problem begins with organized religion. And when you look at the original story, as told through the Gnostic version, they make it very, very clear that the serpent is the benevolent hero of the story. And he calms Eve, and Eve is sort of saying, well, should we not eat the fruit? And the serpent's saying, well, you know, don't be disquieted, because he only told you not to eat of the fruit of the tree of knowledge because he was jealous. He's actually not the god of light. He is the mirror god. He's a dark god. And when you do eat of the fruit of the tree of knowledge, you shall discover enlightenment, which is exactly what you do when you tap into the mysteries. So they obviously go off and bite the fruit, and the official version boots them out of paradise, which tells you everything you need to know about the human race since then. Ever since, we've had to talk to an intermediary to connect to God, whereas the temples, the temple culture, and the mystery schools are very, very clear, and that is that you have to know yourself. The communication with God is between you and yourself and your soul, nobody else. And once you make this journey and you do practice something what they used to call living resurrection, where you actually used to cross over in the temples during initiation ceremonies, you used to come back into the body with an insight. And the idea was that you wouldn't share this insight with anyone but yourself. It was a totally personal experience. And the more you did it, the more you realized that, oh, wait a minute, I am the temple. The temple resides within me, as Jesus said, and if I can just accept that I am a soul living in a body, I can connect with God whenever I want. I can get the answers I want. Well, in the period, that was actually very dangerous stuff. You couldn't go around saying that because you'd be burnt alive or horse-drawn and quartered. So obviously, these stories of Adam and Eve about the creation and tapping into the tree of knowledge was very, very heretical stuff because it was undermining the very foundation of who they are. And obviously, they couldn't have that, and that's why it's sort of heretical. Although, if you look at the original meaning of the word heretic in the original Oxford English Dictionary, it means, and if you're sitting down for this, it's quite funny, a person in possession of the facts who can choose for themselves. That's what a heretic actually means. Oops. Which makes a lot of sense back in 4th century Europe, actually.
Yeah.
When you have possession of the facts, you can choose. Well, you're a heretic. That means you can choose. We don't want you to choose. It's like a sinner. A sinner comes from sin, the lunar goddess. So if you're a sinner, you are worshipping the divine feminine in nature. Well, we can't have that either, because we just built a solar hero out of a guy called Jesus who didn't want to be built into a solar god because he described himself as a mortal man.
Mm.
So you see how these things get totally out of control, and the purpose of the temple was to remove all of that nonsense. There was no boundary between you and the creative force, and that's why it was built as an analog of the creative force, so that you and the temple become one and indivisible.
Well, you know, there's and you could see it. It's the geometry in a lot of the mosques and in some of the cathedrals where you see the mosaic patterns. And to me, they remind me of, like, if, say you would take ayahuasca or something, as some people have described to me, because I haven't. And I know you haven't.
We'll talk about this later.
It's the fractal aspect of nature, and it kind of reminds me of the idea of the kaleidoscope. But it's these patterns are God at rest, or the breath of Allah. I love that in the book.
Yeah, it's lovely, isn't it?
It is.
And it's actually quite wonderful if you actually sort of do the right permissions and you go to the mosques with reverence, and they're more than happy to let you in unless they're extremely fundamentalist. And that's also not good. In most cases, I've been to mosques, and they've actually been quite honored that a Westerner should take interest. And I was asking them about why it's so unusual to find a temple where there's no image of God, which is exactly as it should be, because who do we know what this person looks like? We have no concept. And for them to demonstrate it as pure geometry is quite remarkable, and that's when they said, well, my friend, you are looking at God at rest. If you take a picture of God with your camera, and that's the photograph that you get back. And I thought that was quite interesting until I looked at the old patterns that were photographed of physical objects than an electron microscope. And when you get down to that sort of electrical field around an atom, you see that anything that you see and touch, it actually isn't very physical at all. It's actually made of recurring geometric patterns, as you say.
Right.
And I thought that there was an incredible similarity when you look at these photographs taken of the tips of needles, for example, and you look at them and compare them to mandalas and Native American sand paintings, and, of course, Islamic tile patterns in temples, and it's exactly the same thing. So they had it right down to an art, that at the very basis of what exists, everything comes down to geometry and, of course, its derivative mathematics. The question is, how do they know this? How do they actually understand this? That's what really blows my mind.
Yeah, and well, this goes back to even your Templar books. I mean, when they went into Jerusalem and they dug underneath and they took all this esoteric knowledge, you can look at something like the Rosalind Chapel, where you can see the notes carved into the stone. But in, was it John Stuart Reed?
My buddy.
With his, your buddy, with the thymoscope, who actually showed how those patterns were actually science. And that was the other thing you said, Freddie, in your book. It had to do with they actually went into the temples and they became masters of sound. And the sound was also how they were healing.
Oh, totally.
Right?
In fact, there was one story that I discovered that dealt with those beautiful sticks that you find the Egyptian gods holding when you go to the temples.
The rods.
And when you look at them close up, the head of the stick is like a little animal. It's like the head of Anubis, the jackal that guides you through the underworld so you can get to the other world. So he's like a guide dog that sees in the dark for you when you're out of your body. Mm-hmm. At the bottom of the stick, has two purposes. It looks, first of all, like the kind of stick that you used for catching snakes, which, of course, is an allegory to catching the earth energy, because everything was symbolic. But the other one is that it looks remarkably like a tuning fork. And I discovered that when people were sick, they would actually be taken to the temple. And back then, there was a knowledge of sound. They understood the knowledge of sound to the point where so many of the priests were actually musicians as well. And they could actually look at you like a scanner, and they could actually sense the note that's missing in your body.
Mm.
And they figured out, oh, wait a minute, you're missing the note A. So you go over to your cupboard of curiosities, and you pull out these sticks, which were made from a specific alloy, which is another clue. They were very carefully forged. And when you hit them, they beat to a certain note. So they would stand you up straight. And, of course, the electrical circuit of your body runs up and down your spine. So they would put the stick next to your spine. They'd whack it like a tuning fork several times, and then they'd send you off on your way, and you'd walk upright. And that was part of the whole thing about healing people, is that they recognize that your body is in a state of vibration, as we know. If you figure out the note that's missing and put it back into the body, then the rest of the body vibrates to that tone. Much like the old adage of when you go into a room full of tuning forks, if you beat one tuning fork, only the tuning forks that are beating in resonant frequency with that fork will actually resonate with it. The other ones won't. So it's about putting your body in resonance with or in harmony with its environment. And this is a science that was carried all the way through into the Greek era because, of course, the Greeks learned all of their material from the Library of Alexandria. And this is something that was also found in Britain. So many of the giants' graves and the barrows, the mounds in Britain, also have huge myths and legends and traditions of sound and fairies playing music. Even in France, it's the same thing. So, and it's the same thing with the temples. If you look at the temples, the Gothic cathedrals, the Egyptian temples, even the stupas in Tibet, you start looking at them mathematically, they're all broken down into mathematical notation.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, if anybody understands how notes work, if you take, for example, the base note C, and if you hit a higher C, the relationship between those two notes mathematically is 2-1. So mathematics and music go together very well. And you can see that all the way through the progression of how the temples are built. Even entire cities like Paris, if you look at the historical axis of Paris, for example, which is modeled upon the Temple of Luxor in Egypt, It's just a huge version of it. All the major temples and signs and symbols and talismans on that historical axis are all divided by the musical ratios. So they were trying to build a huge city temple where people would come under the influence of those positive forces. And there's no doubt, I mean, despite the fact that it too, like any other major city, has its problems, but there is no doubt that anyone who goes to Paris feels that there's something very powerful and very elegant about that that city center, because it is. It was designed exactly like a big temple.
Well, you know, that reminds me of when I did one of the issues very early on, which was on the Science Astound. Stuart Mitchell had been into the temples, and he and Richard Merrick had basically said that the Egyptians used to call it the land of honey, which is like the bees, and they used the pyramid as a resonant chamber, and it was the queens who sent out through the temples or through the pyramids. They would basically call people with their sound resonance. That's how it's like, no different than the hive. And how they would get people.
Oh, it makes perfect sense.
Doesn't it? It's amazing. Okay, so here's the other thing.
In fact, John actually figured that out. John Reed.
Did he?
If I can just use his work for a little bit.
Yeah.
Yeah, because he was doing a lot of research in the Great Pyramid, and it sort of struck me when we're having, well, some conversations at the pub.
Yes.
And he's always way ahead of me. I don't even know why I even bother telling him these things. And if he's listening, he's probably laughing right now. There's a certain resonance about the actual chamber when you actually measure the King's Chamber in the Great Pyramid. It's designed exactly to an octave, and the height is the relationship to the golden ratio, the ratio that's found in nature, and
right.
So is a sarcophagus. And I figured that there should be something about that frequency inside the sarcophagus that gets you to have that out-of-body experience. And, of course, he'd already figured this out. And I think about 2 years later, there was a huge project that was done across Europe measuring the sound frequencies of different chambers, all the way from Newgrange all the way to Egypt, and they found that the frequency, well, despite the fact that all these places were different, the resonant frequency was exactly the same. It was somewhere around 112 hertz. And John had actually figured that out already. It was the resonant frequency inside the sarcophagus before the corner had been actually lobbed off, because people had been chiseling it at the corner away. But it falls within that frequency range, which science now knows is the switch, the frequency that switches your logical processing in your brain over to your intuitive side.
So the space was designed
through resonance, through sound, to get you into that state of resonance.
Yep.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, well, here's the other thing. Not only did they do that, but according to what you have here, there are these tellurite. Is that what they're saying it right? Currents? Did I say that right?
Oh, the telluric currents, yeah.
Yeah, and then you say that the ancients also knew that there were these hidden highways, and they were called different things in different cultures. Like.
Yeah, there were the serpent lines. There were if you're in Ireland, it's a ferry path.
Mm-hmm.
The Lung Mei in China. And, of course, they're all the same thing. They all
talk
about these invisible dragons that flow through the landscape. And as any dowser knows, you can locate these with two bent coat hangers quite easily. If you happen to have a lot of money, you can also use a $40,000 magnetometer. And they've done exactly the same thing. They'll go to stone circles and found that the telluric currents are drawn to the entrances of the stone circles, and they basically corral them like big spirals into the center of these temples, which kind of makes the word entrance rather interesting. It becomes an entrance because it literally is the point where you are entranced. You are an electromagnetic being by default. So when you're walking through these doorways, there is this natural current, this geomagnetic current that flows at that spot, and of course you're being picked up, taken in there, and of course it's doing exactly the same thing to you.
Well, you know,
so they figured all this out.
One thing that I thought was really that came my way not too long ago is when you look at all of the entrances, they basically have three doors,
exactly.
Oftentimes, and one is that middle midpoint, and then you have the left and the right, which is the polar opposites: the male, the female, the moon, the sun, the electric currents. And you're always you're always picking between one and the other. And they're always saying when you're walking into the entrance to be, as you would say, altered at the altar. Yeah, I know that's a year. I'm getting that from Freddie.
Took 10 years to figure that one out.
It was a good one, though, Freddie. You know,
next time you'll pick someone smarter.
No, but it all has to do with the construct of the universe being electric magnetic and how these pattern array happens. So you know what I'm going to jump to, because I want to make sure we get through this because we got an hour for you, there's the seven keys, to building a temple so that you know that it's part of you. And the first one is water. So why don't you explain the importance of water?
Yeah, I was actually quite surprised on my walkabout of 2 decades that the first thing that struck me was that how every single temple is built on top of water or adjacent to it or beside it. For example, the cathedrals in Britain, specifically Salisbury and Winchester, they're literally floating on marshland. If you happen to lift a flagstone, the water is literally 4 feet below the floor. So these are very architecturally unsuitable terrains in which to build these enormous edifices. And I thought that was very unusual. And then I went to Monument Valley, and I had the fortunate experience of being taken there by a guide who's actually very spiritual, and he realized that I wasn't there to be a tourist, and he took me to places that most Westerners don't get to go. And you know, Monument Valley is a desert. It rains about maybe 1 millimeter a year, and between these two enormous sand dunes, we drove through them, and at the bottom there was this beautiful crystal clear water gushing between them, and there was a juniper tree. And because it's below the level of the desert, you can't see it from the normal desert floor, and that's where their temple is, that's where their altar resides, and that's where they do all their baptisms, which I thought was very interesting. And the more I began to look at this, the more I realized that water is the fundamental principle of any sacred site, even down to the point where the cathedrals have their holy wells and their fonts, which is basically something that they borrowed from the Celts. The correspondence here, of course, is that water happens to be two-thirds of the water, volume of the planet. It also happens to make up two-thirds of the body of the human person. So there's that correspondence right there, that when you're actually going into a temple, that fundamental principle is there waiting for you. You are connecting with that element. And since we now know that our intent sends out little packets of information, when you do prayer at these sites, a little bit of you actually stays behind. And thanks to people like Masuro Emoto and Jacques Benveniste, the late Jacques Benveniste in France, who proved homeopathy, basically, in the modern era, they basically realize that when you go into these places and you add your prayer, then the water remembers. So no wonder these places are holy, because you are drinking the prayers and the affirmations of the people that came before you thousands of years ago, again and again, which makes these places, some of these holy wells, particularly in the Celtic world, very, very potent. And there is no doubt that even though these are just springs coming out of the ground, and sometimes with a little sort of Gothic structure above them built by the Victorians to protect the sanctity of the spring, there is something very powerful about them. And I'm amazed when I take people on tour to Britain, that to watch them just go to a sacred spring or a holy well, I don't have to say anything. They are totally overcome, and they'll sit there quietly for an hour without anything happening. And it's that spirit of place that takes place because of the resonance in that water.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I did a whole issue on water, and I had this gentleman from Germany who sent me images, and one of them was from a church, and in the signature in the water was this beautiful radiant cross. And some of the other ones he had looked like angelic angels floating. It was just breathtaking. The signature and there was another one where there was a gentleman, Konstantin Kordakov, who was showing how when he put a pyramid on top of the water, that it actually began to build the structure of the pyramid.
Oh, what a surprise.
I know you are, Freddie. I mean, I know, really. So the next one is electromagnetism, which we've kind of covered somewhat, but there are some interesting notes that I think that you have in here, which is like, just like us, these currents that are not just outside of us but within the earth go dormant and sleep at night and wake up with like us in the morning. So again, it's like, again, these things are not different than us. It's just mirroring us, or we're mirroring it, or we're just being part of this big organism. So go for it.
Oh, absolutely. In fact, one of the things I adore about this research is that you're reading these accounts that were written thousands of years ago, and sometimes copied from even thousands of years before. And now, with the fact that we have people in the academic world taking a look serious and open-minded look at these myths and going there with expensive equipment, they're validating exactly what they were talking about. And one of those things that I found amazing was the work of the late John Burke, who actually went around these sacred sites in Britain, but also in the Native American Southwest. And after many, many years as an electrical engineer, and I believe he was also a biologist, he began to realize a correspondence between the way that the temple works during the day and the way it works at night.
Mm.
And to paraphrase his work and the work of other people like him, he basically came to the conclusion that the temples do act like living, breathing organisms because they do attract this geomagnetic force to them at dawn. They seem to attract all the electrical current that's in the ground and circles this current around them. Then it builds up and builds up, and then at a certain point, just before at the crack of dawn, ironically at the moment where plants and especially wheat become most potent in terms of fertility, the moment where that sun just crosses the horizon in the morning, that's when all the geomagnetism floods into the temple and the readings go sky high. I mean, some of these stones, the stone circles, literally are vibrating. They are emitting ultrasonic signals.
Oh, wow.
Literally talking back to you. It's quite something when you then hear it. I mean, the ultrasound's very hard to hear, but there is a buzz, a very low-level buzz. Then he found that during the day, it seems to weaken towards the night. He found the correlation to what happens in the geomagnetic field around the Earth and also the solar wind, because the same thing also happens. You know, at night, the solar wind tends to calm down around the Earth.
Mm.
And then at dawn, it, of course, builds up, and the process starts again. And that process gets repeated on the face of the Earth, and that energy gets attracted to the sites. And, of course, we go in there, we touch the stones, and we pick up the energy like blotting paper. So the earlier you go, the more potent it is. And towards the end of the day, it's like us. We're starting to feel a little bit tired, a little bit depleted. And the site you feel is going back to sleep again, which is kind of fun when you go and sleep in these places at night. It's actually very relaxing. But at dawn, especially at 4 in the morning, and I've done this, and I was a complete idiot back then. I didn't know what was going on. I just recorded these experiences. And luckily enough, I had people who knew about this, who could validate this. But I remember being... I was actually looking for crop circles at the time, and I remember sitting on a mound near Avebury Stone Circle in Britain, the world's biggest stone circle, and I remember quite clearly at exactly 3 o'clock in the morning just shutting my eyes for a little bit just to get a little bit of sleep, and it was as if someone had just drilled this tunnel of light into my forehead, round about where the third eye is.
Mm.
And it was all of these geometric shapes that were very, very brightly colored, almost like argon, beyond the color of neon. And it was just this intense tunnel effect of these geometries pummeling into my forehead. And I woke up with a shock, and I looked at the person next to me, who was one of my mentors, and she looks at me and she says, "Are you feeling okay?" I said, "I'm not sure." And she says, "What's the matter?" I said, "Well, I'm not sure." I said, "Oh, are you getting that tunnel effect with the geometry is going into your head?" I said, "How do you know this?" "Oh, don't worry. The place is just waking up. That's how they communicate with each other, and that's how the universe sends information to itself. They're probably just giving you information for writing a book or something later on in life. Just go back to sleep." And, of course, that was actually how my journey began. Next day, I was just writing down information. I had no idea where this stuff was coming from. So that's how the universe works. It's using the magnetic lines of energy to move these geometric shapes, which, you know, geometry is the universal language of nature.
Right.
That's how nature communicates. So that made so much sense. And that's also why crop circles, the real ones, also communicate with exactly the same geometry and magnetism as you find in a cathedral.
Okay, and that goes back to why they pick certain rocks. You said crystalline rocks were rich in quartz, and that's what we do to what we use in computers, what we use in our watches.
Very much so.
To record and keep time. So we oftentimes don't really look at how things correlate and how we use them, and we think, well, that could be woo-woo, but it's the same technology.
Oh, it's very woo-woo.
Yes.
But then you put some science under it and you go, ah, okay.
I know, and I think that's what's so beautiful about right now is that the science, with all the toy boxes and the tools we have to measure things, we're beginning to go, oh, that's not so woo-woo after all.
Yeah, the seven principles were actually kind of interesting. It's something I made up, but it was based on observation, because suddenly over time I began to realize that wouldn't it be fun? And I'm actually a practical person when it comes down to it. I like to see that what I do has some benefit, some positive benefit for people that they can apply. And I thought, well, wouldn't it be fun if people can't go to sacred sites, if they can build their own? And once I put that idea out, the information just found its way to me. And that's when I realized that all these temples around the world are all built on the same seven laws of correspondence. And stone was one of them. It took me a while to sort of make the connection. But the more I looked at all of these rocks, the more I realized that there's so many traditions that all of these rocks for these temples seem to have always come far away. They may have local stone, but they'll go to a huge trouble to source stones which can be up to 400 miles down the river. And I think, well, what's the point? They could have used the stone that's sitting right here.
Mm.
Well, you start looking at the stone, and I actually trained as a geologist when I was growing up, so I guess it came in useful finally.
Oh, yeah.
All the stones basically had a high content of quartz, which is a piezoelectric material, and which means it can be programmed, especially with an electrical charge. And I thought, aha, now
yep.
That ties in with attracting the energy lines. Now we've got two things working here. But there was two types of stone. One was volcanic, or igneous rock,
mm-hmm.
which is a very masculine stone. And then you have limestones and marbles and alabaster, which is and sandstone, which are very feminine stones. And they also contained a lot of quartz in them, these specific types of stones. But the one thing that unified them all is that they all contained vast amounts of magnetite, and that's where the penny dropped, because the magnetite is also what helps to secure the magnetic lines and anchor them to the position.
Mm.
This is why the energy doesn't move from these places. The stones are literally anchoring them to the spot. But here's the rub. Because of the law of correspondence, there has to be a correspondence between you and the temple. So, so far we have water, we have electromagnetism. We know those exist in the human body. The third thing is that you also are packed with magnetite. And if you look at your blood, as one does every day, and you look at what's flowing through your blood. Don't try this at home, kids. You find that there's a lot of iron flowing through your veins.
Mm.
Now, you think about all the stones, and you remember the old trick where you used to go in science lessons and you used to drop these little iron findings on a piece of paper, and you used to take a horseshoe magnet and
drag that magnet
under the paper,
yeah.
and the findings would follow. Well, that's exactly what's happening to you inside the temple. All the iron in your body that's flowing through the veins of your body are basically coming under the influence of this magnetism. And if that's not the only thing, because your brain contains most of the water in your body because it has to lubricate the brain. Well, dissolved in in all that water are billions of tiny little particles of magnetite as well. That's what allows us to orient ourselves to the magnetic field. So it's going to have an impact on that.
Huh.
And thirdly, because you're having a small deviation of frequency in terms of the local electromagnetic field, it's going to start vibrating your pineal gland, and that's what creates the chemical reaction that enables you to have visions, altered states of awareness, and heightened stimulated imagery. So when you see strange things inside temples, you're not making it up. It literally is a chemical reaction where your brain is trying to interpret things that the temple is trying to tell you. So it's very important to pay attention to those images and visions. That's why people were called visionaries. They came up with some prophetic revelation when they went to these places, because they went away, had immersed themselves in this sort of sensory deprivation of the inner recesses of a temple, and they would come up with this incredible stuff. Plato was one of them. Pythagoras was another one. That's where they got their information from. They had these heightened states of imagination, and they were able to remember it. And that's how they were able to sort of communicate this universal knowledge to the rest of the world. They were literally applying the teachings of the mystery schools. So these things were very, very done very deliberately to sort of get you to become much more than the sum of your parts.
Well, that goes back to, we're going to go, because we've done water electric, we've done stone, and what we missed was sacred measure, but you're kind of speaking to it, because what you're talking about is the stones are projecting that as well. But you know, can I say one thing, Freddie? Because one thing that reminds me of, again, putting it back to us as a body and out there, which is rocks, what we think is separate, but it reminds me of our own bones inside, which like sounds like the rocks, have what we call an electroplesio effect, which is that thing that gets fused into it, the memory that gets fused into it. So we're basically walking around in our own body like it's something that's, when we say it's down to the bone, it's literal. And so,
oh, it's absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. You've got the same sort of quartzite chemistry inside the bones as well. So, yes, you are literally a mirror. And again, it goes back to what people like Jesus were saying, that the temple of the gods resides within everybody. So once you recognize that you are the temple, you don't need a temple anymore, you are a guru, you are an avatar. In fact, I remember a very funny thing that was scribbled by the Greeks who rebuilt many of the Egyptian temples and put them back exactly the way they were, and they were very careful about this. They actually wrote this little line at the end of the Temple of Edfu, and it's almost a joke. They said, "We will keep building temples until people realize that they are the temple." And I thought, that sums it up so well. You know?
Yeah, because you see that.
Because if you realize that you can do this, you know, Indian gurus tend to do, they go off into the state of bliss. They hide as hermits in a cave, and they'll come up totally happy. They don't need cars or television or anything. They found bliss within themselves. They recognize that connection. And it's something that we even do in yoga, for example. Just for an hour, you do connect with that other level of reality by doing these poses, these geometric poses, which do move the kundalini within your body, which get you to have, you know, a certain out-of-body experience and experience that state of bliss, or what Adam and Eve used to call paradise.
Well, there's the ghost, because there's the whole idea of what you have as the sixth one is the orientation, which is like the feng shui, which you're talking about, and each direction has something meaningful. But I'm not going to let you go there because you're only giving me 5 more minutes. And so the other one is what you're basically talking about.
I'll just buy the DVD.
Well, you know what? That's what I was going to tell people, too, because you do have you do have the paradise, the DVDs on how to make your own temple, how to construct it, how to put those energy fields in, because how do you align the sacred geometry to do that, which is key. And then you basically we're talking about the human key is a chemical reaction. The field is only the reality, the awareness of the intent, the sympathetic vibration. The sacred marriage
of natural
flows.
Yeah, I thought it was very
important.
Yeah. I thought it was important to try and sort of teach this in a way to get people to build their own temples wherever they live. I mean, right now I'm talking to you from my apartment where I have 2 temples inside the building. Actually, one's inside the living room, one's on my deck. The deck is quite obvious because you've got all these great big crystal stones there, but the one in the living room is very subtle, but people will always sit in the one place that is the center of the geometry and where the energy lines are trapped there, and they'll feel really good. And they'll say, "This feels really good here." They have no idea where they're sitting, but they know damn well that they're sitting somewhere special, and it's only afterwards that I tell them. So it's very functional and very profound information which can be put to practical use. And the idea was to sort of look at the history of the last 1,000 years where we really have not built temples. I mean, the last temples that we've actually built was the Gothic cathedrals. And since then, you know, not only has society fallen apart at all levels, we've also stopped looking at the sacred. And I think that there is a deficit in relationship to our connection to sacred space. And the more that we start either going to sacred sites or we build them for ourselves where we live and connect with them, the more we start finding a connection to each other and also start rebuilding this, you know, dysfunctional place called Earth. Or should I say, this functional place called Earth that we've made very dysfunctional. So it's a very practical application of ancient systems of knowledge, which are still alive and well. And it brings us back to the full circle to our conversation, where these people build things to last into our lifetime.
Yeah.
They wanted these things to be perennial, and they are, just because the Stonehenge was built in 8,000 BC. And you heard that one right. 8,000 BC is the original temple. These things were built to last into our lifetime because they realized that we would have a deficit at some point, and they wanted to make sure that we would know where to find these laws. And there is no mistaking that when you do travel to these temples, no matter where you are on the face of the earth, that you will have a connection. And when that connection takes place, you suddenly become very aware that you are a god, you are a bright star, exactly as they said on the temple walls.
Well, there was something I mused in the book by it. It's the misguided monks of way back when. You have to explain that, because I just thought that was so perfect. Would you explain that?
Misguided monks.
with their big toys, when they were starting to do things, you know, with their geometric, harmonic, magnetizing, whatever, all of a sudden, you say in the book, you know, geological records of North Europe were catastrophic earthquakes, volcanoes, subsequent nuclear winter because of the misuse of the technology. And it kind of so reminds me of where we're at right now.
Oh, totally. I mean, these temples are designed to get you to open up the sensory experience and attract them to you. And they'll only attract you if it's appropriate, but then all things being equal. If you go in there with your ego and defining the sacred space as being a tool to enhance your own aggrandizement, then that's not going to work. You're just going to throw things out of proportion because that's not what they were built for. So
right.
It'll have the opposite effect. And because these temples are built on the energy lines, which essentially are the matrix of the planet, it means that when you start throwing these ideas around, it starts to expand those egos. It expands your intent. And if the intent is not aligned to the original concept, then all kinds of chaos befalls instead. And you can definitely see a correlation between the misuse of the temple in Egypt and in the Middle East and in Europe, and the correlation to major tectonic and volcanic activity. And we got that from channeled material before I even put that information together. And the two do go together quite well. So I think there is something to be said for that.
So we
right
need
down
some new
to the
leaders.
Modern era. Yeah, even at the modern era of the Freemasons, there are good Masons and there are people who are misusing it to control entire countries, like the one we're speaking from right now. So these people are using the same principles. And what defines the direction of that energy is right action or wrong action, and a wise person knows which one is which.
So here's what I'm going to say. Freddie has quite a few books. He's got one on crop circles. So Freddie, you can name them for me. You got the crop circles. You have the book on, it's the Divine Blueprint?
The Divine Blueprint. It's also known as Common Wealth and Legacy of the Gods, but don't go there. This is
well,
the
that's the one I have. That's why I didn't want to say it. I thought, oh, don't say that, Karen, because that's what the book
yeah,
is sitting
the
for
Divine
me.
The Divine Blueprint.
And you also have some DVDs.
I have a whole bunch of DVDs. I also have a book on the Knights Templar, which is very very original, which talks about the location and of the Grail and actually where it is. That's going to really, really blow your brains apart.
Yeah, I read that
and
one, and I liked
something.
It. I really liked
definitely,
it.
It's definitely challenging. It's very, very good, but the payback is it's like an Ian McEwan novel. You get the clue to the whole book at the very last paragraph, and I love that.
Wow.
And I'm working on something very meaty on resurrection right now, which is definitely going to wake you up.
Okay.
But that's taking place right now.
This is what I decided as I emailed you. I said, I decided if I ever had you at the house over here, I will never, ever, ever play Trivial Pursuit with you.
Oh, no, please do.
You've got like a mind like a steel trank. It's like, whoa. I, you know, it's like, wow, never mind. Never mind. Because, you know, my brothers have that kind of mind that you have. It's like it remembers everything. And being a little dyslexic, I don't. I remember the overview. And it's like, and when I read your books, they're so detailed and they're so full of meaty information. So, I mean, we've just touched and skimmed on aspects of it. So if you really, really want to get into detail and really, really want to know, I mean, he's got angles and lines and why the triangles and how they intersect and nodal points, and it goes on and on and on. And it's just amazing. So with that,
well,
I want
to
thank Freddie. I think it's, Freddie, what's your website? It is on the Awakening Zone. It's
InvisibleTemple.com.
Yeah, because it's not an obvious one. It's not Freddie.
Nah. Well, actually, there's one, freddysilver.com, but that's my photography, my fine art photography. So if you want to buy some fine art photography, you can go there. But if you want to get into the stuff that we're talking about, then invisibletemple.com is the one to go
to. That's the one to go to. And so what I want to say is thank you, everybody, at the Awakening Zone. Without them, we don't have shows. They have put on lots of workshops and programs, and that's how they fund having hosts like me come alive and, you know, making the magazine come alive, and I thank you for that. And with that, we'll say adieu. Freddie, I'm only over 2 minutes. So there we go. So we'll close it off here.
What is time?
What is time? So, and that's not too bad. So there we go. Thank you, everybody, for joining us. Bye-bye.
Thank you.
You've been listening to the Awakening Zone Radio Network, offering insights and inspiration for our evolving consciousness.